you? Is that you?
Hi. Look. Look, you ought to stop this fool around, you hear? Who's in there, damn it?
This must be where the executioner was killed, it's the legend.
Welcome to the Scariest Things Podcast. Scariest Things Podcast is your gateway to horror, covering the tropes and trends of horror. This is episode number
2, season 1.
Episode 2, season 1. For those of you out there who listen to number 1, thank you so much.
Yeah, and your input is valuable. We're appreciating all the input, and in fact, we're going to have a bit of fun with some of the commentary that we got back over the past week.
Yes. So Eric, in episode 1, season 1, we didn't do a super great job of covering the vision, the mission, the point, the whole reason for our being. So help us out. Tell us why we're doing this whole thing.
Well, what we're trying to do is establish a, as we said, a gateway or
not a gateway drug. No. Kids don't do drugs. Drugs are bad. Don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs. A way for the uninitiated to gain an appreciation for horror, or for those people who actually are like Mike and I, who've been watching horror movies for a while, and you've gotten to the bottom of the video bin and you're looking for some other recommendations, we're here for you for that.
Yeah. Maybe you went on a roller coaster 10 years ago and you said, boy, that was really scary. Maybe you went on a roller coaster 20 times in the last 10 years and you said, this is really, really scary, but I need something a little extra.
Yeah.
So, and this is to keep that mojo going.
Yeah, this is the something extra.
This is that something extra that will keep you on the edge of your seat and frightened and scared. But we're going to ease you into it. We're going to be slow. We're going to help you through it. We're going to hold your hand.
Your fragile psyches.
Your fragile psyche will be held intact.
So this episode, what we're going to talk about is some of our favorite moments in horror movies. And I think the power in horror movies often comes from individual moments. I think, and it's different than, we talked about this a bit, amongst ourselves, but the dramas tend to be beautifully strung stories, consistent and well-acted and all that. You don't need that in a horror movie.
Right. It's a compendium of beautiful scenes that seamlessly are drawn together with a great through line. Horror movie, you just need one good punchline.
Yeah. And granted, if you get the full meal deal,
that's a whole different story. Yes.
But I think that the emotional resonance that comes through horror movies comes through the big shockers, and they stick with you for a long time. They're the things that sit in your crocodile brain and remind you what it is to be a human. And
or
it has the
anaconda brain.
Yeah.
Which is also for another episode.
Our guilty pleasures. That they have this deep connection with you that you, and I think comedy can do it, but horror does it really well. And so with that,
well, I don't want to jump to the top of your list just yet.
Oh.
What was the, and this might be on your list,
okay,
but what was your first memory in watching horror where there was a scene, mm-hmm, that still sticks with you today? This may or may not be on your list, which is fine.
Yeah, no, what is
that one?
The one that sticks with me, my first scary movie moment was King Kong. Watching it on a black and white television.
Jessica Lange.
No, not that
Jeff
one.
Jeff Bridges.
Fay Wray. This is the 1933 King Kong, and it was where King Kong busts through the subway and his head pokes through, and you can see his whole face coming through, and you realize how big he is, and I was hooked. That was, King Kong, big and scary. It's funny nowadays,
right?
It's you know, King Kong's a hero. He's right. He's kind of adorable. But when you're a 7-year-old kid,
big and scary,
and he opens his mouth and he wrecks
black
a train,
white screen,
and he shakes him out like it's a Pez dispenser, right? So that's that was great, and that was my first moment. What was yours?
Oh boy, you know, there was probably ones earlier in this, but I do remember vividly. I was probably, I want to say, 5th or 6th grade, so whatever that would put you at. My folks went out for the afternoon, and I was of that age where you could kind of hang, or starting to hang by yourself for a couple hours, you know, unattended, no parental controls. They went out on a Saturday afternoon. Now, mind you, it was light out that Saturday afternoon. It wasn't dark. It wasn't windy. It wasn't rainy. There was no thunderstorm. There was none of the normal horror tropes. It was bright and sunny out that day. And Creature Feature on the local Spokane, Washington...
So UHF.
UHF affiliate. They showed Psycho. And ooh. I started to watch it from... step one, and as I got into that film, obviously the scene that really stuck with me then was the scene when she goes into the basement and discovers Anthony Perkins as the mother. That's terrifying.
But not the shower scene.
Not the shower scene.
Okay.
But then nowadays, you know, the scene that really gets me is obviously the scene at the very, very end of the film where he's in the jail cell and he's talking to himself, muttering. That is still just absolutely terrifying, and especially coupled with the layering of the imagery, dragging the car out of the lake or the pond or whatever it is. That was the one that really, like, I thought, oh my God, I was actually paralyzed on the couch.
You're too young to watch that.
Well, isn't that the whole point of this podcast?
Yeah. Well, and there's your
kids, don't watch horror movies.
Well, there's your fantastic scenes linked with a terrific plot, and that's when
right.
you get Psycho.
Right.
Or you get
right.
The Shining. Or
right.
you get
there's not many of those.
The Thing. You get some the greatest of the greats are the ones that have both the fabulous scene stealers,
yeah,
and that common thread that keeps you hooked.
Yeah, there's like 10 of them.
Yeah,
maybe 5.
I think you go 10 deep.
Maybe 15. All right. So who's going first? You going first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Okay. So
what do you got?
So
starting number four. This is number four.
Numero cuatro. So this is a 19. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a 2003 film by Alexander Aja.
Ooh.
Who is? Yeah, it's his first film. He did this when he was 25. I mean, just a kid. And you and I saw this together, and I chalked this up to the best slasher. This had the potential to be the best slasher film I've ever seen. And I'm not really a slasher fan. But this one was startling. This is High Tension.
Ooh, yeah.
The home invasion sequence,
yep.
Where our protagonist, and she's visiting her friends in a cabin French farmhouse, and her friends get descended upon by a brutal murderer, and it was the pacing was brutal. It was fast. It was violent. The protagonist did everything right. The villain was doing everything right, and it was a cat and mouse. That it's the best cat and mouse I've seen in a horror film. And
agreed,
it was nasty. It was fantastic start. Now this is a movie that has a twist, and I won't spoil it for you, but it really drops the movie down a few pegs because of a twist that they have in the end. So I don't know that I would over-recommend that. The overall movie isn't one of the greatest ever, but this opening sequence is the best slasher sequence I've ever seen.
A little too smart for its own good,
yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah, it's like you didn't have
too
to go
smart.
There. Yeah,
it was a double-double twist. Double-double-double-double twist.
And I think that...
Didn't need to do
I think you chalk that up to Aja's youth. I think that He was trying to be to pull a Tarantino or a Shyamalan or
right.
kind of things like, I didn't see that coming. And I was like, you have no reason to see the twist coming. But if he had stayed the course with that first what that first sequence did, it was darn near perfect.
Yeah.
It
is subtitled, so watch out, because, yeah. like, if you're not one of those reading types, you're in for 2 hours of French.
Yeah, but you don't need subtitles to realize what happens when a guy gets his head removed with an oak trunk. So
you're spoiling it.
Sorry. Well, that's okay. What we're doing, right? These are the moments we got to spoil a little bit of it.
Yes. All right.
What's your number four?
Number four is the 1979 classic. Eric covered this director last week, and I was jealous because I didn't think to cover this director, but this is the 1979 classic by David Cronenberg, The Brood.
Oh, yeah.
Which is arguably, again, this is for a later podcast, some would say it's maybe not even a horror film because it's just this weird, super weird psychological thriller that's got all of these strange science fiction components and these weird sort of things happening on the screen.
And body disfigurement kind of stuff.
Yes, an institutional wife, a series of brutal murders, mutant children. It's kind of got it all. The film received a lot of mixed reviews when it first came out, I think because people were confused as hell by it. Still, if you watch it today, it's as confusing as hell. But the one scene that really got to me, and it's kind of got that classic sort of 70s vibe where it's quiet, there's not a lot of buildup, there's not a lot of tense music, and the scare comes in the quiet, and the quiet builds and builds and builds, and then climaxes with these dwarf-like creatures, which sounds kind of hokey, and they look a little strange now in retrospect. But these dwarf-like creatures come out of the woodwork, and the one grabs I believe it's a meat tenderizer, and starts banging the heck out of the protagonist, Juliana, and she's ultimately bludgeoned to death by this meat cleaver. And it was just the collection of all of these different pieces and parts, the quiet, the slow build, and then this just absolute non sequitur, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this dwarf-like creature with a meat cleaver. Again, I know I'm not doing it justice, but when you see it on the screen, pretty damn terrifying.
Dwarf with a meat cleaver.
Dwarf with a meat cleaver. That's our next podcast. Dwarf with meat cleaver.
Okay.
All right, let's go to number three.
Okay.
Number three.
My number three, Mike and I saw this together when we were young. We saw this at a movie night in the dorms.
Ooh, okay.
1988.
Oh my goodness.
This is, and it's not the greatest movie, but I love this scene. This is The Blob. The hospital scene.
The original Blob?
This is the 1988 Blob movie.
The 1988 Blob, okay.
Okay, and
and not the Blob 2 with the Larry Hagman.
We're
jumping ahead of like a decade or so to...
Right. This is
Blob remake.
Blob remake, and it's got a bunch of really fun scenes. It's kind of an idiot movie, but I do like me some monsters.
Yep,
and it has a surprise. The surprise is that it's the football hero Paul and his girlfriend, who actually is the lead protagonist in the film. They go to the hospital to bring the old homeless guy into the hospital because he had something attached to his arm, and the Blob gets the old guy with the just absorbs him, and Paul does this, okay, I better call for help, and he looks up, and the Blob drops on him, and it's the classic don't look up, right?
Right.
We could do a whole podcast, and I'm sure we will have a podcast of cliches in horror movies of look up, monster gets you.
Yes.
This is the best look up, monster gets you, because then the Blob drops on him and his girlfriend comes out and he's covered in Blob and he's beginning to melt. And she screams, and then he reaches his arm out, and she tries to pull him out, and she pulls his arm off. And then you see the Blob just starts dissolving the guy, and his skull comes, it crushes him. And it's just like, oh, wow, it's like, that was so gross and so cool. And it was the guy who you thought was going to be the hero of the movie. It's like, and it was off. It was a surprise.
Misdirection is always good.
Oh yeah, and that was,
and suffocation and cramped spaces, claustrophobia is also good.
And it had to be practical effects. This was 88. The CGI. Yeah. Now they tried to do it in CGI and it would look stupid. I think they probably took a big old gelatinous blob and dropped it on a.
That's a lot of J-E-L-L-O.
Yeah, and it was.
That's a lot of J-E-L-L-O.
It was cool. So I thoroughly enjoyed that. There was another scene later on where a guy gets his head grabbed and gets pulled into a sink. Also kind of cool. But again, great scene. Not a great movie. Great scene.
Great scene. Yes, that is a good one. I had totally forgotten about that. I'm going back and watching The Blob, and you should too. All right. We're now on to number three. All right, so I'm sticking with the 70s with also film Eric and I saw together. This is called Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
Oh,
it's a 1971 horror film about the nightmarish experiences of a psychologically fragile woman in an old farmhouse in Connecticut. And the thing that's great about this film is, if I haven't already disclosed this, I love when there's not a lot of exposition and it's really left to the viewer to decide what the heck is going
this
on.
This is a prototype 70s horror film. And as Mike is loved to point out, is slow burn.
Super slow burn. And the thing that's great about this film is that Jessica, the main character, obviously in the film, Let's Scare Jessica to Death, you ultimately don't know if she's seen the undead. You don't know if there's really vampires. You don't know if she's losing her mind, or you don't know if maybe all three are the case. And there's a scene which I think probably a lot of the teen slasher films involving cabins in the woods and campgrounds and camps stole from, in that they use the lake as sort of the device for the scare, and a vision, an undead person, a vampire, we don't know, emerges from the lake, and the entire time as the woman is emerging from the lake, this we don't know if it's a, we don't know if it's a specter, we don't know if it's a ghost, we don't know if it's a vampire, we don't know what it is, as she's emerging, all you hear in the soundtrack and in Jessica's head are all these thoughts that are kind of streaming together.
Sorry.
So basically what happens is she emerges from the lake, and as this specter, this harpy, this ghost-like apparition is emerging from the lake, there's all these crazy thoughts running through Jessica's head, and you realize, you do see how fragile she is, and you do get a glimpse into this, like, terrifying proposition that, you know, maybe she really is just crazy and can't actually comprehend what's happening, or maybe something horrible is happening that she just can't comprehend. In either case, it presents a really, really scary film, and the film has got a great feel to it. It's real dark, real scare, and I'll tell you, this is the ultimate spoiler alert. At the end of the film, you don't have any idea really what happens
to her or for her or by her.
It's a big mystery, which is great.
I'll admit, I really enjoyed that movie, but I didn't have a strong impression from the scene.
Mm.
I think it was an overarching kind of a sense of,
right,
sort of this creeping dread,
right.
And it was, you know, it was part mystery, part psychodrama, part,
right,
you know, and so it wasn't straight out hit you in the face horror.
True.
So it had a nice arc to it.
Yeah.
Moment to moment to moment, kind of peak valley. I think that one had a nice arc.
Right. I'll take an arc.
Yeah.
Number two.
Okay. So this is a 2007 movie that Mike and I saw together in the theater.
Oh yes.
And this is a bit of a controversy. This is a love it or hate it movie, and this is a love it or hate it scene.
Mm.
This is The Mist.
Oh, yes.
John Darabont. Yeah. And here, spoiler alert. Spoiler.
Are you going all the way to the end?
I'm going all the way to the end. You have to,
dark.
Because It is the most brutal finish to a movie.
Extra dark.
Ever. It is. When we left the theater, there were people they were glum. It was like end credits, people just hanging their heads, leaving
the cinema. There is no shower that can clean the sludge off you.
However, it was powerful. I thought it was fantastically done. I thought it was brilliant.
No question.
Some people go, oh, it's horrible. And what happens here? So this is an adaptation of a Stephen King novelette by Darabont, who goes on later to do The Walking Dead.
Right.
And the end sequence features lots of Walking Dead people that it's got Laurie Holden, who plays Andrea. It had Jeffrey DeMunn, who played Dale.
Huh.
It had Melissa McBride, who plays Carol. They were all in
Walking Dead prequel.
It was a Walking Dead prequel, but the lead is Thomas Jane, and it's a band of survivors who are fighting off creatures, or trying to escape from these horrible creatures that have descended in a mist upon their little New England town.
Right,
and
it may or may not be the government.
Right, and it may or may not be a plane to another existence, a Lovecraftian thing, or it could be mutants. You don't know exactly what's going on, but these monsters come in all shapes and sizes, and they're killing everybody in town. So this one band, and again, I refer back to the previous podcast where my number one love of a horror movie is if you get strong protagonists who you care about. And they did a great job with this surviving group. You had the key surviving group. You had David, who was the Thomas Jane's character, and Laurie Holden and Jeffrey DeMunn and an old lady and David's kid. They managed to get in a car and escape. And they ran out of gas. And they think the world's going to end. And David's got a gun with four bullets, and there's five in the car. Shoots everybody else in the car once they go, yeah, I can't, I don't want to live in this world. Shoots everybody in the car. Just is tortured by the guilt. And then the fog lifts and the military arrives. And he realizes if he had just waited 10 minutes, they would have survived.
Maybe an homage, I don't know, to Night of the Living Dead. As you were saying that, I think, you know, the end scene of Night of the Living Dead was obviously had a political tone to it. Because it was racially oriented, but maybe an homage to that, which is
Actually, that's darkest close number two. I mean, that's like shooting the protagonist.
It's like
root for the hero, and he dies at the finish.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same kind of a thing, but this is not the protagonist is left to wallow in the shame of killing everybody he loves, and then imminent rescue was only minutes away.
Right,
it was like, oh, heartbreak, sorry. and that was a total kick in the nuts.
It was a kick in the nuts.
And the audience felt it.
Yes, I agree.
And it sticks with you. Everybody knows that ending.
Okay.
Love it or hate it, you know that ending.
Indeed. That's a good one. All right, number two for me, The Ring. This was the 2002... not the Japanese version from 1998, but the 2002 version, the supernatural horror film involving a video cassette tape, which, again, doesn't really sound very scary.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of the things that scare the Japanese, things like hair and water, aren't. I must be missing something, because this isn't the scene I'm headed for. The scene I'm headed for. So the main character in the film is played by Naomi Watts, and her name is Rachel, and she kind of goes on this quest.
This is The Ring.
This is The Ring, not Ringu, the 1998 version, but The Ring. So she kind of goes on this quest to suss out this evil videotape, this evil video cassette, and in her quest, she has to go to an island to speak to a woman on the island who may know more about this mystery. And again, this is more of maybe in the same vein as the last film I was talking about, Let's Scare Jessica to Death. This might be more of a sort of an arc moment, because again, Let's Scare Jessica to Death is sort of, it builds and builds and builds. Much like The Ring's got lots of jump scares, it's got lots of scares, but it's also got this very, very heavy dread that runs through the whole film. Yeah. And I'm not just talking about the gray, kind of dark, sepia tone that the whole film was shot in. I'm talking about the film itself. And the scene I'm talking about is she gets on a ferry and she befriends this horse on the ferry and starts to talk to the horse, and the horse is ultimately spooked in the one of the most chaotic scenes you'll ever see, where the horse is running around the interior of a ferry, which again sounds almost impossible. She makes an attempt to halt the horse as it busts out of its carrying container. The horse jumps into the water almost as if it knows how terrible and horrible its fate is going to be, and kills itself, but not before, as they have a great shot. I don't know who the cinematographer was on the film, but there's a great shot looking down from the ferry, and you see the horse basically trying to scamper up back up the side of the ferry, and it's ground up into a million pieces. And I remember just seeing the scene going, oh my God, like, it's terrible enough that this woman is potentially going to die, that her kid is going to die, that she's cursed for all eternity, and she's got these weird, long-haired, wet girls chasing her around the Northwest. That's not bad enough. Now she's a horse killer.
And the crazy-eyed, they meant the horse, the wild-eyed panic in the horse's eye.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, so if you're an animal lover, and I apologize if there's any animal lovers out there, probably not the one for you, but if you can stomach seeing a horse off itself, this might be an interesting one to give a look to.
That was a great scene. That was unforgettable scene. That one and the girl crawling out of the well.
Girl crawling out of the well, super weird.
Yeah,
super
and
weird.
Coming out of the well and out of the TV, and it's like, oh no!
Out of the well, out of the TV. I will say that set the stage. I mean, that has been ripped off both satirically and otherwise so many times in so many different ways. The movement, the look, the feel. You know, basically every single film from 2002 on owes a lot to The Ring, because prior to The Ring, there wasn't any of that kind of specific creep.
Well, and I think that it borrows from a number of other Japanese films in that it has this sense that you can't get away from whatever's happening.
Right.
That it's this constant, you said that it's a weight, it's a pressure that you,
right.
that trying to shed this curse.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, there's a lot of those things. So, number one,
let's see number one.
Number one is...
Better be good.
15 minutes of pure insanity. Okay. This is 2012's Cabin in the Woods.
Ooh.
This is...
Love it.
It's the opening of The Cubes.
Yes.
And...
Not to be confused with Cabin in the Woods 2.
No. No, this is... Not different movie. There is a bunch of wit and satire and just raw, terrific homages to other movies in Cabin in the Woods.
Oh yeah.
And the end sequence, and again, this is, since we're talking about moments, we're spoiling stuff for you guys.
Sure.
Right? So our protagonist gets stuck in...
There's no harm in watching the film twice. It's okay.
No, I've watched...
You can do it.
I've watched Cabin in the Woods, I don't know, it's like five or six times. So this is a... They find out, the kids who go to the cabin in the woods find out that they're part of a grand experiment. They don't know exactly what's going on, but they've been plagued by horror tropes that have been foisted upon them by Bradley Whitford of West Wing fame,
right?
Who is fantastic. He's got the best death in the sequence too. But we'll talk about what actually happens once our plucky protagonist managed to uncover the secrets of this of the plot, and they find themselves in these glass cubes amongst hundreds, if not thousands, of these archetypal monsters. There's a there's something that looks like a centipede from Hellraiser.
Human centipede.
Yeah, and we didn't see that. We did see like a there's this giant super cobra thing,
right?
And a bitey ballerina with just all teeth. There's there's a wolf man. There's a flying bat. There's hundreds of these monsters, and there's a moment where these kids find the panic button, and they hit the panic button, trying to get away from these government stooge types who are actually doing a betting pool on how these kids are going to get eliminated, and they turn the tables on them by unleashing all the monsters at one time. And it is just, at that point, it's so much happening on the screen at one time. You're laughing, you're stunned, you're just shocked at what you're seeing on screen.
Laughter is the only way the brain can process it.
Right, and
but it's really terrifying.
Yeah, it was these poor people are just getting lunched, and it turns out there's a big Lovecraftian close to it, but the spectacular element is 8 elevator doors opening, and in about 2 seconds, all the monsters rush out. I think when we were in the theater, I think I must have squealed when that happened. I was like pure glee at watching what was in front of me. And there's some other things like there's a unicorn that comes out and gores some a unicorn. I was like, it's a unicorn. No, it's evil. And Bradley Whitford, who had been trying to bet that the kids were going to unleash the evil merman, which you didn't really see through the whole movie. He's like, oh, come on, I want to... Oh, they're going to pick the merman. He gets killed by the merman, who looks like a Jabba the Hutt meets a ghoulie.
Justice.
Yes, it was awesome. I had so much fun with that. Mike, what's Justice. Your number one?
Number one. I'm going to go back to the classics. And this actually, if you Google something like top 10... scariest films, you're going to get your Shinings, you're going to get your Exorcist, you're going to get your Jaws, you're going to get your Psychos. This is probably among them. This is the 1973 classic Don't Look Now by director Nicholas Roeg. Sorry, Nick, if you're out there and I'm butchering your name. This is a Donald Sutherland joint. Donald Sutherland was a very young man in this. It's a great film. Again, it sort of plays with this whole idea of dead and undead, and you know, longing, and missing, lost friends, lost relatives, etc. And Donald Sutherland, the scene I'm talking about, there is again sort of this, and you're seeing the theme here for the night, the escalating sense of dread throughout the whole whole film. And Donald Sutherland ultimately doesn't know if the dead really are walking around him. And it culminates with him and some very strange early 70s kind of European music in this Italian palazzo, where he's going from dark corner to dark corner, turning down hallways, turning down alleyways. Well, he does look back, and he's ultimately chasing his, I guess maybe his subconscious. There's probably a lot of metaphorical stuff going on. He's chasing his deceased daughter, or what he perceives to be his deceased daughter, as he's going through this Italian palazzo kind of maze, and ultimately he finds his daughter, who is wearing this very simple kind of red jacket, and there's a sense of like relief brought to the audience, and you think, oh, okay, well, everything's going to turn out okay. He's found his deceased daughter, when in fact, and again, sorry, but this is going to sound dwarf really hokey. Dwarf with a, I think just a knife.
Really?
Just plain old knife.
Oh, I was kidding. Apparently,
I'm afraid of dwarves. I just learned this tonight. I'm afraid of dwarves.
Stay away from the Hobbit.
There's this strange little woman dressed up like his daughter with a knife. She pulls the knife out, cuts Donald Sutherland's neck open. He bleeds out all over the place, but he's bleeding out all over the place mixed in with this almost what can only really be described as like psychedelic scene or series of scenes and images flashing before you.
Wow.
And it's just crazy. I came to this one kind of late in life. It was recommended to me about 10 years ago by a neighbor who knew that I liked horror films and said, you should watch Don't Look Now, and I did, and whoo,
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's a good one. Okay. It's a good one.
Well, I'll put it on my list.
It's a good one. All right, so coming to our final part of the podcast, last week I think we characterized it in episode one, season one. We called it the Pick and the Pan, but we felt like it needed to be a little bit more scary, something a little bit more evocative. And so instead of telling you one film you should watch and one film you shouldn't watch, we needed a hook, we needed a catch, and we came up with Undead, Dead.
Yeah.
And these are the two films that that each of us are going to tell you that you should see and not see. So what do you got for The Undead?
The Undead film, which is the one that you should see.
Yes.
I have is Your Next.
Ooh, which, good one.
It's a home invasion spectacular.
Yes. I think, what year was that?
That was 2014.
Yep. Okay.
And it is...
Clever, but not too clever.
Clever, but not too clever. It's a dysfunctional family that comes under siege from a bunch of crossbow-wielding masked villains. And it is... The pacing is fantastic. The look, it's got a great... It's got a great look to it. The acting is great. I think the
lots
story,
of good twists and
the
turns.
Story, yeah, the twists are the right kinds of twists, unlike High Tension, which pushed it too far.
Yeah.
This one, you would like a good mystery. They put the breadcrumbs down for you to follow.
Yep.
And so you're sort of just maybe a quarter step behind them, and when the truths get revealed, it's very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big dysfunctional family. You're kind of rooting for some characters, and you know the classic kind of picking who's going next. But I thought it was it's part of this new wave of great indie horror films.
Yep.
That's under the radar. It doesn't have the feel of I Know What You Did Last Summer or sort of the super pretty people. It's just like this feels like real people under siege.
Yep.
And I think it's a part of a really encouraging trend in contemporary horror.
All right, so check it out. Otherwise, you are next.
All right. You're undead.
You're undead. My undead is the 1976 classic Race with the Devil featuring none other than Peter Fonda, Warren Oates, and Loretta Swit.
Really?
From MASH. Yes. The Race with the Devil is a great film. It follows two couples that are vacationing together in an RV from Texas to Colorado, and they're terrorized after they witness a murder during a satanic ritual. And who doesn't love satanic rituals? So, like, if you like satanic rituals, this one's for you. It gets a little long at the end. It gets a little silly. It kind of devolves into a big long chase movie. But it's a really, really fun movie, and, satanic rituals are inherently fun, clearly, but it's got some great performances by Peter Fonda and Warren Oates, and if you love those folks and you want to take a step back in time and...
A lot of weed and acid in that one?
A little weed, a little acid, a little Satanism, who doesn't love that? Come on. All right, so what is your... Dead meaning bad, not dead meaning good.
Dead and should stay dead and buried.
Stay dead and buried. What do you got?
This is the example that not all 1970s horror movies were great.
I like it.
Mike and I had great expectations for this film. Ooh. And it turned out to be this is one of those classic setups. This is we're gonna work the urban legend thing, and this is When a Stranger Calls, 1979.
Yeah.
And everybody knows the trope of the babysitter watching the kids, phone rings. Are you watching your kids? Yeah, they're upstairs sleeping. You better check your kids. And just
Eric,
getting pestered.
You're scaring me.
Yeah. So they play that out to its logical conclusion. You didn't check the kids, and the kids are all dead. And it's like, well, that was in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And then it becomes a police procedural.
Yep.
And a boring police procedural. It was slow as molasses. I mean, I was tempted just, I think we, you know, one thing that when Mike and I get together and do horror movie binges, we'll get 6 DVDs and we'll go, let's put one in. And I think on multiple occasions I threatened to switch the video out. Mike said, well, maybe it'll get better. It never got better.
No, if you're looking for a good 20-minute scare, this is the film.
It would have been a great Twilight Zone episode. And in fact, I would be stunned if it wasn't a Twilight Zone episode.
Turn it off after 20 minutes.
Yeah. Turn it off. That was a disappointment.
Yes.
Should stay buried. Try it again. Do it differently. Do it better.
Yep. Well, they did. That was remade in, I think, 2000, I'm going to say 9. 2006, 2009?
Was it better?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a stink on that one.
We'll get back to you on that one.
We'll do that on the next binge.
All right. So my dead film that should stay dead and is associated with the dead, George Romero, rest in peace.
Oh.
This is a 2009 film, and George Romero is one of my all-time favorite directors. But he did a film in 2009 called Survival of the Dead, involving these feuding families, some of which were inexplicably Irish, which didn't exactly make sense. And it was, I believe, off the coast of New England somehow, some way. And it involved zombies and, you know, a group of sadistic hunters. And it just, like, the whole thing just, it didn't make sense. It was kind of boring. The whole concept of these people from Ireland that came to this island didn't really make sense. It was never really explained, and it was just a sad movie. In that, you know, it was kind of the end of or towards the end of George Romero's career, and I don't know what the whole backstory is, but it did seem like it was definitely kind of phoned in.
He ran out of gas. It was this was like Van Halen after David Lee Roth left. It just there was not much left in the tank.
It was a tough one. Pretty depressing.
Yeah,
yeah, indeed. All right, well, I think that's all we have time for this week. So thanks for joining us, and until next week, don't look under the bed.
There's something waiting for you.
Matthew, is that you?
Hi, look. Whoever you are, stop this fool around, you hear? Who's in there,
dammit? This must be where the executioner was killed. It's the legend.